Welcome to Outbeat Now, part of Outbeat Radio, right here on KRCB FM Santa Rosa. Outbeat Radio is a program produced for, about, and by the LGBT community of Sonoma County. We air each and every Sunday at 8 p.m. I'm Jeff Basham, and here with my co-host, Greg Moralia. We have a very special guest tonight for the first half of this hour. California State Senator Mark Leno will join us to discuss his political career and recent developments around LGBT rights in California. Later, Greg will welcome Shane Widmeyer of Campus Pride on the Outbeat Youth segment. Greg and Shane will be discussing being an LGBT freshman in college. All that and more is coming up. First, the Outbeat Radio News. Take it away, Greg.
And good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for Sunday, July 24th, 2011. On Thursday this week, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, advised President Obama that the military was indeed ready for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. After their meeting, President Obama signed the certification for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and sent it to Congress. Now, another waiting period begins. President Obama said, "Today we've taken the final major step toward ending discriminatory Don't Ask, Don't Tell that undermines our military readiness and violates American principles of fairness and equality." The president added, "In accordance with the legislation that I signed into law last December, I have certified and notified Congress that the requirements for repeal have been met. Don't Ask, Don't Tell will end once and for all in 60 days on September 11th, 2011. And in New York, the marriage equality bells rang loudly today for the very first time. Some 823 couples entered in the lottery to win one of the 764 available spaces in New York City today. The city announced the lottery earlier this week in response to overwhelming preliminary demand for marriage licenses online, where more than 2,600 couples, most of them same-sex and from New York, applied since July 5th. And here locally, Prop 8 Love Stories, a play about the effect of the California law that denies equal marriage rights for same-sex couples, is headed to New York. The show's 16 Sonoma County actors, who are 12 to 17 years old, will perform the play at the 4th Street Theater in New York City Friday for 7 performances beginning July 29th. The off-Broadway run is the ultimate destination for the show that started a year ago with performances at 3 Sonoma County theaters and 2 San Francisco theaters. Prop 8 Love Stories was born when young actors interviewed 8 couples, 5 same-sex and 3 mixed gender, about their relationships, and then they wrote a play using the couples' words. Cast members Audrey May Tatum wrote 4 original songs for the show. The show explores love, life, and discrimination. The talented young people portray the couples word for word in a potent, moving, hilarious theater experience. Months ago, the show's director, co-writer, and the founder of the Walking Elephant Theater Company approached the show's cast, their parents, and other supporters about arranging for the show to go on the road. New York theaters and producers had heard about the show and were very interested. Anastasia Mott Austin, the Walking Elephant Theater Company's managing director, set out to calculate what it would cost to send the cast and crew to New York. The $30,000 cost seemed daunting, but everyone was determined to get the talented young people, one guardian, and the small crew to the Big Apple. An online auction was launched, the Russian River Sisters helped with a bake sale, and a benefit performance was arranged. The sold-out performance, which happened last month at the Person Theater at Sonoma State University, was to be Prop 8 Story's final West Coast performance. But one additional performance happened last week at the Marin Shoal of the Arts in Novato. About $5,000 was raised with the help of all of the involved and our local LGBT community, which has responded most favorably to Prop 8 Love Stories. Tickets to the benefit show were sold at last month's Pride Comedy Night and at the Sonoma County Pride Festival. All but one member of the original cast will not only perform the show that they helped create, but they will take in shows and a tour of New York. Rhonda Feinlings, whose daughter Kira is a cast member and who along with her wife Heidi are featured in the show, said, "It's exciting to be taking the show to New York on the heels of gay marriage becoming legal there. Heidi and I may try to get married while in New York. I hope that through this play, we can show New Yorkers what the long walk towards equality has been like for those of us in California." Now here's a list of events for the coming week. On Tuesday, July 26th at 1:30 p.m., the Santa Rosa Senior Group will meet at the Glacier Center in Santa Rosa. And at 6:30 that same night, the Transgender North Bay meeting will take place at the Positive Images Center, 312 Chin Street. And on Thursday, July 28th at noon, the Women's Brown Bag Lunch will take place at 30 North San Pedro Road in San Rafael. At 6:30 that same night, the Men's Peer-to-Peer HIV Group will meet at Face-to-Face, 873 2nd Street in Santa Rosa. And finally, at 7 o'clock on Thursday, the Positive Images Youth Group will meet for their weekly meeting at Santa Rosa High School. If you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatradio.com. Just click on Outbeat Radio News. For Gary Carnevelli, I'm Greg Moralia. Jeff, back to you.
Welcome back to Outbeat Now. This is Jeff Basham, and it's my great honor and privilege to introduce to you Mark Leno, California State Senator, who joins us tonight to discuss LGBT issues and his political career. Thank you very much for being with us tonight, Mark.
My pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found your way to the State Senate?
Well, I came in a bit through the back door. I'm otherwise a small business owner. I started a sign company in San Francisco in 1978. As the business grew, I gravitated toward volunteering for many community-based organizations. And given the timing, there was, of course, no shortage of work to be done during the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And I found a very dangerous thing about myself, that I had a facility for fundraising. Dangerous, because then, of course, everyone wants you on their board of directors, because no one likes to do that.
That's right.
And my fundraising for nonprofits became extended to raising money for political causes and for political candidates. I subsequently raised some money for Willie Brown's first race for mayor in 1995, and it was in the spring of 1998 when he offered me an appointment to the County Board of Supervisors to fill a position that was left vacant when Supervisor Susan Leal was elected treasurer for the County of San Francisco. So, as I say, a bit through the back door, I never thought of running. I never would have run. I was very ambivalent about accepting the appointment, but about a year into it, I realized that I truly love the legislative process and loved serving the wonderful city of San Francisco, and subsequently the district in the Castro, which was my area when we switched to district elections in year 2000. And then my ambivalence became an ambition when there was an open seat for the state assembly in 2002. At that time, there had never been an openly gay man elected to the state assembly. We had elected at that time four lesbians, but no gay men. And in 2002, my colleague John Laird and I were both elected to the State Assembly, where I served for 6 years before being termed out in 2008, at which time I got elected to the State Senate.
Well, that's pretty incredible, small business owner to State Senator. So you've got another term available to you in the State Senate if you want it, right?
Yes, the term limits allow for up to 3 2-year terms in the Assembly, which I've mentioned that I've served, and then a potential 2 4-year terms in the state Senate, and my first term will come to an end at the end of next year. We're waiting to see what the final redistricting lines look like, and also, equally if not more important, the number which the new district will be given. Odd-numbered districts come up for election in 2012, which would work well for me. Even-numbered districts don't come up for election until 2014. So, as I say, we'll just wait and see what the new commission does, independent commission does, and it's not in my hands, so I have to be philosophical about it. I would very much enjoy serving another 4 years in the Senate, though it's quite possible that I may not be with the opportunity to serve Marin and Sonoma residents another second term, because the lines indicate they won't be finalized until August, that San Francisco may lose one of two Senate seats, given that our population, proportional to the rest of the state, is not growing as fast, and so the new Senate district could be all of San Francisco with a little bit of San Mateo County. My 4 years of representing Sonoma and Marin will potentially be behind me, but I really love serving the North Bay. It's such a great part of the state.
Sure. I think it's the best part of the state.
Well, I think my Senate district's the best Senate district in the state.
Absolutely. So I guess that would sort of summarize your opinion about the whole redistricting discussion. It's not something you're in favor of?
I've never argued that the legislature should have the sole responsibility for the decennial task after the census of redrawing lines to make sure that districts still have equal numbers of people, given that we know population shifts occur every 10 years. I've had some concerns about the ballot measure that created this new and independent commission for a number of reasons. It's a 14-member commission. There are 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 4 other individuals. Given that about 44% is represented by Democratic registration and only 30% Republican, one could honestly ask, why are there 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats on this commission that doesn't represent the state?
Right.
So that's one concern. Another concern is that of the 14 members, 3 can veto what 11 want. That's not very democratic.
No.
That 3 would have more power than 11. And that's because the ballot measure requires that a majority of each of the major parties, meaning 3 Republicans, 3 Democrats, must approve the maps, which also means that 3 Republicans or 3 Democrats could veto the maps. But we'll see how it plays out. I would never want to suggest that these commissioners are doing anything than a very devoted and arduous task of redrawing the state lines.
The state budget for next year was approved and signed by the governor on time and without much drama despite all the talk about the huge deficit. What was different this year?
Well, don't overlook the drama that for the first time in the history of the state of California, a governor vetoed a budget. Short of that, the big difference, and I'm glad you've asked about this, the big difference is that voters passed Prop 25 last November, which for the first time in a half century allows a majority of legislators to pass the budget as opposed to a two-thirds majority. And the problem with any kind of two-thirds majority threshold is that it literally puts the power in the hands of the minority. And that is antithetical to the whole concept of democracy, which is majority rule. So in stark numbers, we are 40 senators, 25 Democrats, 15 Republicans. 27 is the magic number of the two-thirds vote threshold. So what this means is on any matters currently related to revenue, because we still have a two-thirds vote threshold to put in place any additional revenues, 14 senators can veto that which 26 senators want. 14 have more power than 26. Would someone explain that to me? That is a formula for dysfunction, and that is what has led the legislature to be so unable to pass a timely budget each year, because the majority wants and has a responsibility to make these decisions, but we don't have the authority. So this year, we had the authority to pass a budget, which we did, but it certainly was not our first choice of a budget because we couldn't add any revenue. Can I explain the complexities of a $80, $90, $100 billion budget to school children? And I tell them, you know, it's really second grade arithmetic. It's addition and subtraction. You either increase your revenues or you decrease your expenditures or a combination. But if you take addition off the table, you can't do your job appropriately or thoughtfully. So we have made very serious cuts to our social safety net. Anyone who may be the recipient of or has a family member of a recipient of either SSI, SSP, for elderly, blind, and disabled individuals who live on $600 grants from the government, being cut even further. We're looking at a serious threat to adult day health care services, serious threats to our CalWORKs program, which is a proven successful program of assisting mostly single mothers from welfare to work. And then, of course, we've seen horrible cuts to what once was the best, most accessible, and affordable higher education system the world had ever seen. Well, we've been disinvesting in the University of California, the California State University system, as well as community colleges. 100,000 Californians will no longer be able to attend community college in the coming year. And tuitions continue to soar by thousands and thousands of dollars, making them less accessible to middle-class and working California families. This is the price we pay for having insufficient revenues. And no one likes to talk about taxes, especially in a down economy. I'm not suggesting it's a pleasant topic to even be considering. But when you realize that the wealthiest of the wealthy are paying a lower percentage in personal income tax than when Ronald Reagan was governor of the state of California, the corporations and their taxes represent a smaller share of total tax revenue than they did just 5 or 10 years ago. The question is everyone paying his or her fair right. share? So there are prices to be paid for this, and we're paying this price. And now we have balanced our budget on some, and we believe, appropriately expected revenue to be realized by the end of the calendar year. We have about half of that already in the bank, so we know that revenues, tax revenues, are coming back closer and closer to pre-recession levels. But if they don't materialize, we will be cutting significantly into K through 12 education, potentially seeing the school year shortened by 7 days. Larger class sizes, more teachers being fired. This is not a good thing for our children or for the next generation.
What about cities and counties? I've heard that one of the big changes of the budget is a shifting of responsibility for housing felons from the state prison system to the county. Tell us about that.
Yes, everyone is going to be feeling some of the pain. Though the first issue you mentioned, the realigning of custody for low-level offenders, nonviolent, non-serious, non-sex offenders from the state to the county level will, in fact, I believe, not only in the long run save money, but also produce greater results. I have seen the State Department of Corrections grow from 5.3% of our general fund spending as recently as 2003 when I arrived in Sacramento to 11% of general fund spending today. Can you imagine we're spending as much on corrections as on higher education?
Yeah, yeah.
This is a red flag for everybody. And the governor's proposal is to shift custody of about 38,000 low-level offenders, not releasing them, but shifting their custody to the local agencies, specifically the county. And when I say get better results, even though we are spending exponentially more at the state level on corrections, we're not getting decent, hardly admirable results. We have twice the recidivism rate of the national average. Recidivism defined as a released offender reoffending once out of custody within 18 months. 18 months. The average around the country is around 35%. We're closer to 70% in California.
Wow.
That's because when they're in custody in state prison, we're just warehousing these prisoners in overcrowded conditions. They're getting little, if any, rehabilitation. If they have a drug problem or alcohol problem, it's not getting treated. They serve their time. They get out. They are about 70% functionally illiterate, meaning they can't even read a sign directing them to the unemployment office, much less fill out an application for a job. They've got 70% have an alcohol or drug problem. They are ostensibly and virtually unemployable.
Right.
What do we think is going to happen?
Sure.
They're going to reoffend. And it's just a merry-go-round. And the more we take these, in many cases, most cases, fathers out of their families, this cycle repeats itself from generation to generation.
Right.
Wouldn't it be better to find a more thoughtful and cost-effective way of dealing with this population then reinvest the billions of dollars of savings into education, which we know is the best crime preventive tool known to humankind.
Sure. Well, you're not going to get any disagreement from me as an educator. I agree with you. I think education is absolutely the key to getting people back on track in their lives.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit, Mark. You've been such an amazing champion for same-sex marriage in California. The matter now seems to be stuck in the courts. Can you give us an update on where you think things are headed and your thoughts about the eventual outcome?
Sure. Of course, we're all still so thrilled with the success of the New York state legislature. And even more importantly, it would not have happened without the leadership from the top. Governor Andrew Cuomo made this a priority issue. Can you imagine? We've never had a governor that's made marriage equality a priority issue. But I want to remind folks that our legislature, the California legislature, beat the New York legislature by 6 years. We first put a marriage equality bill on Governor Schwarzenegger's desk way back in 2005. We did it a second time with even more legislative support in 2007. Of course, he vetoed each of those bills. I remind folks, unfortunately, unlike Andrew Cuomo, our governor hadn't understood the importance of his own marriage vows that he took 25 years ago, but that's another story. In any case, given the passage of Prop 8, we, the legislature, can no longer weigh in on this issue. Only the courts, and at this point, a federal court, or the voters can provide marriage equality here in California. And it's quite likely that we will prevail even further up the chain of the federal court system, and that will play itself out over the next couple of years. And of course, there is an ongoing debate as to whether we are prepared, both with sufficient public support and also the necessary millions of dollars, to go back to the ballot in 2012, which would be the most optimal since it is a presidential ballot, to try and overturn Prop 8. So those are the possibilities. Those are our options, and they will come into greater clarity in the coming months.
Sure. Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. Well, Senator Leno, marriage has not been the only issue in our community you've been a champion for. I mean, we have Harvey Milk Day because of you. But your most recent bill that the governor just signed earlier this month, the Fair Education Act, is going to go a long way, I think, to helping combat bullying and other issues facing LGBT youth. Tell us about the Fair Education Act, and what does it do?
Sure. FAIR is the acronym for Fair, Accurate, Inclusive, and Respectful Education Act. And it very simply will require, in statute, that the role and contributions of LGBT Americans, not unlike the role and contributions of African Americans, Asian Americans, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, European Americans, and a number of other traditionally overlooked groups, be included in our K-12 curriculum. And I think this is very important for any number of reasons. It will certainly benefit our LGBT students because for so many obvious and many reasons, all the negative voices they have put into their heads, to learn that they are part of a proud community which has a history and has had historical figures and leaders will only increase their self-esteem, their self-respect, and give them the encouragement, hope, and inspiration to be able to pursue every dream of theirs, which is their birthright. It'll be beneficial for their straight counterparts because, as we know, kids at a very young age figure out that the kid at the next desk is somehow different. We may not have a word for it or an understanding of what makes them different, but kids know that there's something else going on. And right now, there seems to be a license to pick on these different kids, to harass them physically, verbally, emotionally, so severely that we have this unbelievable, tragic, ever-growing phenomenon of 12 and 13-year-olds committing suicide as a result of this kind of harassment.
Right.
We even know of a case in Ventura County, California in 2008 when a 12-year-old boy was shot dead in his sixth grade classroom by a fellow 12-year-old student.
Right, Lawrence King.
Lawrence King. And when the teacher asked this assailant, 12-year-old assailant, why did you do this? He said that his classmate was too girly. Well, we're failing our students if we aren't teaching that that girly young boy is part of a community which has historically been demonized and discriminated against, and which in the recent decades has had success fighting for its civil rights, its full inclusion in society, and to be treated equally under the law as is guaranteed by the United States Constitution. This is a critically important page of civil rights history. And we know, factually in data, that school districts which currently have this inclusionary curriculum, such as the LA Unified School District and the San Francisco Unified School District, that students who are exposed to this inclusionary curriculum experience lower levels of harassment and bullying across the board. All sorts of bullying is decreased. And what we're really talking about, if I were to put it into one sentence, we are requiring that schools teach the broad diversity of the human experience. And when you think about it, isn't that what education's really about?
Absolutely.
Tell us about some of the other issues you're working with and what you hope to get accomplished in the coming year.
Oh, we're working on a wide variety of interests and issues. One bill I can tell you about, which has some agricultural aspects to it, of course, Sonoma having a very proud agricultural community, it would give legal right to California farmers to grow industrial hemp. Now, industrial hemp, for those who may not be familiar, is a distant biological cousin of marijuana, just that, a distant biological cousin. They are both cannabis sativa L plants, but whereas marijuana typically has somewhere between 5 to 15% THC content, that being the psychoactive ingredient, in industrial hemp, by international definition and definition in our bill, the THC content can be no more than 0.3%, which is the definition of trace amounts. A good analogy would be that it has no more THC than the poppy seeds on your bagel have opium, just trace amounts. But industrial hemp currently is used in the manufacturing of thousands of legal products here in California and across the country. From industrial hemp, we can make food, clothing, shelter, paper, fuel, all biodegradable products, all returns to the earth without any waste. It's renewable every 90 days, grows without herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, grows with less water than corn or rice or cotton. It is a great crop for California. And given that we import it from Europe, from Canada, Mexico, China, South Africa, apparently it's only illegal when it's growing in the ground. This is crazy. We're denying farmers a piece of the action of a growing $400 million a year industry. And unfortunately, though we got this bill to Arnold Schwarzenegger's desk twice with bipartisan support, he vetoed the bill both times. We will get this bill to Governor Brown's desk later this summer, again, with even stronger bipartisan support, and I'm hoping he'll be more thoughtful about this than Jerry Brown. Our farmers throughout the state are struggling so and in need of a great cash crop, which this would be.
And we've been speaking to Mark Leno, California State Senator. Mark, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Outbeat Now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show, and I hope you'll invite me back.
And we'll be back with more right after this music break.
Have you lost your way? Living in the shadow of of the messes that you made. And so it goes. Everything inside your circle starts to overflow. Take a step before you leap into the colors that you seek. You give back what you give away, so don't look back on yesterday. Wanna scream out, no more hiding. Don't be afraid of what's inside. Wanna tell ya, you'll be alright in the aftermath. Anytime anybody pulls you down, anytime anybody says you're not allowed, just remember you are not alone in the aftermath. And you feel the weight of lies and contradictions that you live with every day. Well, it's not too late. Think of what could be if you rewrite the role you play. Now take a step before you leap into the colors that you seek. You get back what you give away, so don't look back on yesterday. Wanna scream out, no more hiding. Don't be afraid of what's inside. Wanna tell ya, you'll be alright in the aftermath. Anytime anybody pulls you down, anytime anybody says you're not allowed, just remember you are not alone in the aftermath. Oh, in the aftermath. Before you break, you have to shed that armor. Take a trip and fall into the glitter. Tell a stranger that they're beautiful, yeah. So all you feel is love, love. All you feel is love. Wanna scream out, no more hiding. Don't be afraid of what's inside. Wanna tell ya, you'll be alright in the aftermath. Anytime anybody pulls you down, anytime anybody says you're not allowed, just remember you are not alone in the aftermath.
That was Adam Lambert with his original song Aftermath from his Glam Nation live album. You're listening to Outbeat Now, right here on KRCB FM Santa Rosa. It's time now for the Outbeat Youth segment. Welcome, everyone, to this month's edition of Outbeat Youth. I'm Greg Moralia. Outbeat Youth is a segment for and about LGBT youth here in the North Bay and beyond, and you'll find us here every month as part of Outbeat Now. Well, next month, a number of our listeners are going to be leaving home to attend a new college, so we thought it would be a perfect time to invite back our good friend Shane Windmeyer, who's the creator and executive director of Campus Pride. Shane's written several books about coming out while in college, as well as how to find an LGBT-friendly school. And he's with us tonight to share his best advice about how to find your community once you arrive at your new school. So, Shane, welcome to Outbeat Youth.
Greg, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you were on with us last year and talking about the Campus Climate Index and about how to find an LGBT-friendly college or university. But before we get into tonight's topic, tell us a little bit about Campus Pride and what you do.
Oh, sure. So Campus Pride is a national nonprofit organization that works with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and straight ally college students across the United States. And our primary goal is to build future leaders and to create safer, more LGBT-friendly colleges and universities.
And when was Campus Pride created?
Campus Pride was created in September of 2001. So we're actually approaching our 10-year anniversary this September. We started as an online network called Campus Pride Net back in 2001. And about 4 years ago, we became a full-fledged nonprofit organization, a 501c3 status. And, this year we'll celebrate our 10-year anniversary, so it's quite exciting.
Well, congratulations on that. Tell us about the LGBT Leadership Camp that you held this last month.
Yeah, our camp is in its fifth year. It's a social justice leadership camp for lesbian, gay, bi, trans, and ally college students. We bring together educators, teachers, entertainers from across the United States. This year it was hosted in Nashville, Tennessee. It was just this past month, and we're, so excited. We had about 60 college students go through the program. It's 5 days, five nights. It's camping in the best way you can with air conditioning. And we just, it's a great experience. Students leave camp with friendship, and they leave with an action plan to create change on their campus for the year to come.
And who were some of the speakers that you had this year?
Yeah, so Mara Kiesling is the executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. We honored Daniel Hernandez Jr., who was the young man who was credited with saving the life of Gabby Gifford in Arizona.
That's right.
He received our Voice in Action Award. We had Lou Copas, who was dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As a military service officer, and Blue came and spoke about kind of the future of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and his own personal story. We had some entertainers as well. BB from season one of RuPaul's Drag Race came and entertained, and she was fabulous. Randy Driscoll, Randy.
Absolutely. What a great singer she is.
Yeah, Randy is one of my sweethearts. She wrote, as you know, the benefit single for the Matthew Shepard Foundation, What Matters. And so Randy's actually came every year to camp, and she does it out of the kindness of her heart, and she's just a big believer in Campus Pride.
I understand Campus Pride is also partnering with several sports celebrities that have come out as allies, Ben Cohen and Brian Sims. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so Campus Pride was one of about four national organizations that work with LGBT issues to be a network partner with the Ben Cohen Stand-Up Foundation. And Ben Cohen Stand-Up Foundation is against bullying in all aspects of bullying, but also specifically for sexual identity and gender identity. So Ben Cohen, if you don't know who he is, he's this international rugby athlete who's, like the number one rugby star in the world. He's just an amazing individual. He's a straight ally. Him and his wife and their two kids basically have made, LGBT causes their, signature thing that they believe in. And the Stand Up Foundation was created kind of send a national message through Ben Cohen and his work. That, it takes just one person to stand up against bullying
sure.
And to not allow, don't allow yourself to be a bystander. And so we're involved with that foundation and very proud of that. There'll be some new programs coming up through this fall and spring with Campus Pride and some of the other network partners. And then Brian Sims, if you don't know Brian, Brian is a college athlete who came out as the football coach, as the football captain to his coach. And Brian, has helped our organization over the last 2 years kind of reach out to college athletic programs. Campus Pride is working on an assessment with Brian and some other athletes to look at how LGBT-friendly coaching staff are, athletes, the entire athletic program on different college campuses.
Well, that's great. We'll look forward to hearing more about Brian and Ben's work with you. Well, tonight we're here to talk about going off to college, and a number of our listeners are, in fact, getting ready to do that next month. They're going to be leaving home and entering as a freshman at a new campus someplace in the country or in the state. As an LGBT student arriving on campus for the first time, give us some advice. What should our students look for?
Well, presumably you've already chosen a campus, and so, you know, one of the best things to do when you get to your campus is to make sure you know what resources there are. And you can even do that before through Facebook. Campus Pride has an index at campuspride.org, which allows you to look at different campuses and what they offer around LGBT issues. But definitely get to know what resources are available to you, whether it be a student group, whether it be, safe zone programs or gender-neutral restrooms, what does the campus actually commit to offering LGBT youth? And, you know, if you're comfortable, you know, make sure you are visible on campus in that first 2 weeks so people know that you're interested in LGBT services. One of the big problems that LGBT youth often encounter on campus is they don't know where services are, and the campus doesn't know who the LGBT youth are. A very, very, very small percentage of colleges actually have a way of asking optionally whether or not a student is gay, lesbian, bi, or trans through college admissions or through orientation. So you want to make sure you're out there if you feel comfortable. If you're not out and you still want to know what's going on, you know, it gets a bit more tricky. But at the same time, you can typically find that through our website at campuspride.org. It's 2011, and you would think that more colleges were welcoming and supportive, and I think we're getting there, but, you know, less than 7% of colleges across the U.S. actually have institutional support for LGBT students. So we still have a long way to go.
Sure, sure. Now, when you say make yourself visible, what does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, I mean, it's partly what we do every day of our lives as LGBT people is coming out when the opportunity presents itself. It's not that you have to wear rainbow flags. Ultimately, being visible is just being yourself, being out, and coming out when the time presents itself. Hopefully colleges are getting better. Campus Pride is trying to get colleges to allow students to come out in traditional ways, such as college forms. And so, for instance, in your orientation, there should be a way for students through a form, if they choose to optionally come out as gay, lesbian, bi, or trans. So that way you know, and the college is going to take responsibility, which is huge, for the college to take responsibility, not for the youth to have to find the resources, but for the college to take responsibility and get the LGBT youth the resources that they need, because they know that there are LGBT youth who have come out, whether it be through college admissions or whether it be through orientation.
Right. And I would imagine the living situation would present its first challenge. You know, when you show up and you meet your roommate or your dorm roommate for the first time, should you come out right away? What's your advice?
Well, I think it depends on the individual and how comfortable they are. Some young people I've discussed this issue with, they'll feel more comfortable waiting until their roommate knows them a little bit better before coming out. And ultimately, this is the challenge that I find really ironic for, 2011. Students should not have to be educators where they live, in my opinion. So the fact that you're gay, you should be able to go to bed and get up, do whatever you need to in your room without having to educate your roommate on what it means to be gay, right?
Right.
You can do that in other ways, in my opinion, on a college campus. But we kind of put in residence life different diversity. Okay, let's put people together, and then they learn from each other. I totally get that on a floor level, but in your own personal room, I think that gets to be a challenge. So I really leave that to the individual. I think most importantly, be safe. Tyler Clemente, a young man who committed suicide last September at Rutgers, if there would have been ways for him to self-identify or to mark a box when he was admitted into the campus related to his sexual identity, or even just roommate matching and be able to be matched with a roommate that was very friendly. I mean, those are all things the college should be doing to take responsibility. It shouldn't be on the youth who come out and then, okay, is it going to be a good experience or is it going to be a bad experience?
Right.
So that's something we need to work through as a college community, is the philosophy of educational kind of roommate matching versus, okay, someone should feel safe first in their roommate choice as opposed to just putting them with someone they don't know.
So what happens if you do come out to your roommate and you discover the person's very homophobic, or just through the natural course of time you discover this is just not a good match, or perhaps even you're in danger? What should a student do?
Well, you definitely need to go to your RA, to the housing office, if the RA is not responding. A good RA will not say, oh, it's okay, just kind of get another week, you guys will be fine, right? A good RA will not say that if you go to your RA and you say, you know what, I'm gay, I came out to him, he, you know, responded in this homophobic way. A good RA will escalate that immediately to the housing office and find you a different room.
Okay.
I would say on about 10% of campuses that are committed to LGBT issues, that will be the case. Now, keep in mind, if that doesn't happen, or if you're still experiencing problems, which we had a student who came to our camp last year, that was in 2010, and he went back home and was put with a roommate in his college residence hall, and he's a very out young individual. And, you know, for a good 2 weeks, he was emailing and calling me concerned because of threats he was getting from his roommate because of how he expressed his gender, and just really awful stuff. And the college was not moving him quickly enough. Like, he still had to be there every day.
Wow.
So, you know, Campus Pride can assist you with that, too. I mean, we ended up contacting the housing office to escalate the issue because once they were aware that, you know, an organization like Campus Pride was stepping in, it tended to move the issue more quickly. But at the same time, most colleges, sadly, reactively will do something. I just wish they would do it proactively so a student doesn't have to experience that in their first, you know, 2 or 3 weeks on campus.
Right. Well, that definitely wouldn't be a good way to start out the school year. Well, I know a lot of students who aren't out when they start college use the college experience as a time to come out and identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. You know, what are your thoughts about that? Is college really the ideal time to do that? And what particular challenges are there for transgender students?
Well, Campus Pride this past September in 2010 released the State of Higher Education for LGBT people. And, you know, I came out in college, and I found it to be one of the most rewarding, one of the most liberating experiences I've had in my life, and it was very positive. I came out to my fraternity brothers, and my fraternity really stood by me. And granted, there were a few guys in the house who had some issues, but, you know, as a brotherhood, we were able to work through that. You know, there are stories that are very supportive and very, you know, in many respects, give support to everyone coming out in college. But it really is situational. It depends on your family support. It depends on, you know, your finances and how you got to college. You know, there's a lot of things to keep in mind. But I would say young people today, by far, are very supportive of LGBT issues. The problem presents itself in the region of the country or the state or the politics of that state. Our national survey that we did showed that 23% of LGBT students, faculty, and staff encountered harassment. For our transgender students, that percentage was even higher. So for trans youth, it's particularly difficult. And for students of color who are LGBT, it's particularly difficult. And the harassment, the physical, violence, or the safety of transgender people is oftentimes more hostile, more blatant than a lesbian or gay young person. So there are some very serious issues to keep in mind, and I think it's situational. But, you know, there is a place once you get on the campus, if you aren't out, you know, kind of get to know your friends, create a support network, find out it, you know, you'll know or you'll feel it when you can trust someone to come out to them. And most people today, you can see through what they do, their actions, their words, whether they use homophobic slurs, whether they make jokes about gay people, you know, you'll be able to tell if it's okay to come out to them more than likely, based on my experience.
Okay. Well, let's talk about fraternities and sororities for a bit. You wrote a couple of books about your experience coming out in a fraternity. And how have things changed today? Are there LGBT-specific fraternities and sororities? And what's your recommendation?
Well, you know, my first book came out in, I believe it was 1998. So, yes, things have changed. I actually came out to my fraternity brothers in 1994. And, well, as a result of that, I decided to write a book about it, and that first book was called Out on Fraternity Row, and it was a bestseller at the time in the gay and lesbian community. And so then I decided to write another book, and basically I've written three books on the topic, all of which I'm very proud of. And today, there definitely has been a change in culture around fraternities and sororities. There are more individuals who are coming out to their brothers and sisters. There are more individuals who are rushing or going through recruitment, openly gay and lesbian. But one of the changes that I've seen is that is if you are what some might call straight acting, that's really what the issue is to a lot of men or a lot of women, is when you conform to the gender expression or the gender that they expect of a brother versus a sister. So, for instance, what we might have seen as gay discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination is really gender identity or gender expression discrimination, in that if a gay football, you know, and I'm using football as a straight acting persona, but if a gay football guy comes through Rush, you know, he's going to get in because he fits the image of what maybe some men considered to be their brotherhood, right? But if a straight, effeminate, you know, young man were to come through the same fraternity, he may not get in. It's not because of his sexual orientation, it's because of how he expresses himself. So I've seen that be more nuanced over the last, you know, 15 years since the release of, you know, my first book and since I've come out. It doesn't mean that there's not gay or lesbian or bi discrimination in fraternities or sororities. I just see the topic of transgender, kind of gender expression, being more relevant to fraternities and sororities today than I did 10 years ago.
Huh. Okay. Well, at least there's been some progress. Well, for our aspiring college students who are going to be looking at transferring, let's say a year from now, tell us about the Campus Climate Index as a tool for them to use to find an LGBT-friendly campus.
Yeah, so, you know, Campus Pride has an index, the Campus Climate Index, or Campus Pride Index, and it looks at kind of LGBT-inclusive policies, programs, and practices. So, 3 P's, policies, programs, and practices. The one it doesn't look at is perception, right? Because you have to ask the students, the faculty, staff on campus what their perception is. But what we found is if a campus has a strong foundation of policies, programs, and practices, then they're going to have a you know, an environment that supports the academic success of the student. And so, you know, the index is a valuable tool. You can find it at campusprideindex.org for you know, anyone to search for campuses that have come out as LGBT friendly. And I say come out because we ask our students to come out, we ask our faculty, our staff to come out, but colleges also need to come out. You know, Campus Pride has long advocated that every college needs to take responsibility, and you've heard me say that a couple of times, that colleges must take responsibility for the students that they're admitting, the students that are going through orientation, but this index really provides them that opportunity to exercise kind of how they're going to be safe, welcoming and supportive of an LGBT student.
Great. Well, I know from working with it myself, it really is an amazing tool, and it's the ideal place to start your search for the best college. I mean, there's no point in spending a lot of money and time traveling around to different campuses only to find that it's not an LGBT-friendly place. You can go to the Campus Climate Index at campusclimateindex.org and do some initial searching based on regions in the country and the type of college that you're looking for, and you'll see exactly what that college has to offer you in terms of support before you start investing time in filling out applications and campus visits. Now, if you missed that website earlier, we'll have it on our own website at outbeatyouth.com. We'll have a link there you can just click on right to the Campus Climate Index. Shane, before you go, tell us about the New Year's Day cruise. I'm very, very excited about this, as you know. I'm going to be on board with you, but tell our listeners all about it.
You're one of the featured presenters and speakers on the cruise, so I hope all your listeners will come and support you and take a cruise to the Caribbean with Campus Pride. It's quite exciting. We partnered with Stonewall Tours, and we're going to be taking a New Year cruise. So it leaves January 1st from New Orleans, and then it returns to New Orleans on January 8th. And I believe, you know, my husband and I are going down the day before, going to spend New Year's Eve in New Orleans, along with you and, you know, your husband Tony and everyone. So it'll be a great time. It's one of those things that there's educational things to do on the ship. You know, you're doing a presentation. I'm doing a presentation on, you know, how to, you know, look at your campus as LGBT-friendly or your alma mater as LGBT-friendly. Brian Sims, the football player, is going to be on the cruise, and, you know, he's going to be doing some workshops. He actually, beyond just being, you know, an athlete, he's also the president of Equality Pennsylvania. So he has a lot of activism and political experience. Our beloved Randy Driscoll will be on the cruise, so she'll be doing a special evening cabaret on Love and Hope, which will be fabulous. We'll have drag bingo, which I know you're a big fan of, Greg.
Absolutely.
You and your drag. Drag bingo will be on the cruise. So, you know, if you book with Campus Pride, you get all these extra activities to do on the ship. It's going to be a fabulous time, so...
It will at that. And if you'd like more information about the cruise, again, you can go to our website at outbeatyouth.com. We'll have a link that will take you right to the page with all the details and a link to make a reservation. We've been talking with Shane Windmeyer, who's the creator and executive director of Campus Pride. More importantly, he's our good friend and ally. Shane, thanks so much for spending tonight with us on Outbeat Youth.
Greg, thank you for all your hard work. I appreciate it.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Outbeat Youth. Remember, you can follow us all month long on MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter. Past shows are always available for listening and download on iTunes. Thanks for listening. And that also brings us to the end of Outbeat Now. Join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. for a special Outbeat Extra. I'll be here with Gary Carnevale and three local LGBT politicians who will be talking with us about their experience serving local government and about some of the challenges facing cities and our county here in Sonoma. Then Jeff and I'll be back on the fourth Sunday of August with another edition of Outbeat Now. Have a great week. Outbeat Radio.